For decades, a mystery has haunted Tamworth.
Mark Anthony Haynes' body was discovered on an isolated stretch of train tracks.
No one talked about him because he was just another little black fella.
An ABC True Crime podcast was followed by a fresh inquest.
Drum was just holding their breath.
If he didn't do it directly, he knows what happened.
With the truth closer than ever, hear the whole story now. Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wandjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, a couple of huge stories to round the week out.
So the BBC has apologised to President Trump.
You're going to hear from Lewis Goodall, one of the co-hosts of the Newsagents podcast, about why he thinks criticism of the BBC has gone a little too far.
Quite frankly, this is being blown out of all proportion for the substance of the issue at hand.
Then back home, the Liberals have agreed to ditch net zero by 2050.
We're recognising that climate change is real, that we have to do our fair share, but we will do that in a balanced way.
The minister formulating the Liberals' policy, who's been hearing from all sides of the party, Dan Tehan, will be here too. And we'll head to Tasmania as the debate around the state's proposed footy stadium finally reaches Parliament.
With my heart, I support a stadium. Tasmania deserves to have the infrastructure that other states have, and we deserve to have an AFL team, but not at any cost.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, thank you for being here for the final Breakfast Wrap of the week. And once again, the Liberal Party and its discussions on net zero is one of the headline stories of the day. The party's now finalised its position that they'll ditch the target to reach net zero by 2050. The coalition will be discussing its joint policy on the weekend. Ahead of that, though, you will hear from the minister responsible and also from our Friday political panel. But before we get to all that, this big news at a broadcasting house in London. The BBC has apologised to Donald Trump for a Panorama episode which spliced together parts of a speech that he gave on the 6th of January 2021. The fallout from the scandal has been huge. High-level resignations from the BBC, the Director-General Tim Davey and the Head of News Deborah Turnus walking out the door this week. Donald Trump gave the broadcaster until Friday night, local time, to respond to his demands for an apology, a retraction and compensation over the edit. Otherwise, he said he would sue the broadcaster for $1.5 billion. There's been speculation right across the week around how the BBC would handle this. It's already apologised and acknowledged the mistake. But this morning, it went further. It apologised and confirmed that the programme wouldn't run again. The chair of the organisation even wrote a personal letter to the president, apologising for the edit. But the BBC hasn't actually paid Donald Trump any compensation, so it's only met two out of three demands. Other broadcasters have previously settled with Donald Trump. ABC America and CBS both paid millions to Trump foundations after he lodged lawsuits with them. So why hasn't the BBC done the same? Well, you can look at its statement. A key line says, quote, "While the BBC sincerely regrets the manner in which the video clip was edited, we strongly disagree there is a basis for a defamation claim." As you're about to hear in this interview, the broadcaster really doesn't think that the president has a legal leg to stand on. If you listen to the Newsagents podcast, you'll know Lewis Goodall. He's a journalist and he's a broadcaster on outlet LBC, and he's also the former BBC Newsnight policy editor. He came on with Sally before this news broke that the BBC had apologised, essentially explaining why he thinks it's all a bit overblown.
How damaging is this whole saga for the BBC?
It remains to be seen how damaging it is in terms of public trust, because of course we must remember that President Trump in the United Kingdom, a bit like as in I suspect in Australia, is a pretty unpopular figure, even among Conservative voters and Reform Party voters, the kind of, you know, radical right party in the UK. He's a relatively unpopular figure, but it's certainly politically difficult. It's very politically difficult for the BBC to find itself, which hates to be at the centre of any sort of political controversy, to be in a position, however absurd in some ways, to be in a position where it is being threatened with legal action by the President of the United States. And we've become kind of, that has become normal and normalized. It's obviously very, very unusual, but a very, very difficult position for the BBC to find itself.
How much of this is about not only the mistakes that have been made, but the way in which the BBC has responded to concerns about bias and the speed in which it has responded?
The reason that it took them a long time to respond to these accusations around this edit on this show of Trump is because there is clearly division at the heart of the BBC board about how to respond. I think my understanding is that, you know, roughly half wanted to put out a statement which said apologise for the edit but went no further. And the other half basically wanted to apologise not just for the edit but for the idea of a kind of wider bias against Trump. And as a result, they just couldn't agree and they said nothing. So that is a problem. For me, this whole thing is an example of how different parts of politics now are just almost living in different sort of planes of reality, right? Because on one level, it's clear that there are huge numbers of people who are deeply, deeply angry about this edit. And indeed, it was a poor edit. It was an edit that was made in poor judgment. It did mislead the viewer to some extent about Trump. It suggested that he was saying something that he wasn't. But look at it another way. In any fundamental sense, did that one edit detract from what Trump did on January the 6th? No, it didn't really.
It was a fundamentally misleading edit, wasn't it? It removed context there.
But did it in any way fundamentally misrepresent what Trump did that day or in the days leading up to January 6th? It misrepresented what he said at that moment. Did it misrepresent his actions on that day and in the days before? I find it very difficult, very, very difficult indeed, to credibly argue that it did. And that's why if Trump did want to take it to court, which the BBC I'm sure doesn't want, but if it did go to court, for every bit of legal analysis I've seen says that Trump would find it very, very difficult to win because, frankly, with regards to January the 6th, he doesn't have much of a reputation to defend.
Isn't it the duty of the journalist to get the edit right, get the detail right, provide the correct context and let the audience make up their own minds?
Of course it is, and it was a poor edit. But look, the question here is President Trump is trying to suggest that that edit fundamentally altered his actions and his behaviour on that day and in the day up to January 6th. He's trying to suggest, and this has been a part of a much longer and wider effort by him and his movement, by the way, trying to downplay his role in that day and in that event.
It has Is that more reason to get it right?
Of course it is. Look, you're not going to... I'm not arguing with you that that edit should have been made, but like, what is more a more grave error here? Is it suggesting to the audience, is it that edit, which was a bad error, don't get me wrong, or would it be suggesting to the audience in any way that President Trump's role in what happened on January the 6th was less than it was? Although that edit was in error, the overall context is that Donald Trump was responsible for what happened that day. That's not me saying that. That's the congressional impeachment process saying that. And it's the fact that so many of the January 6ths themselves
have said it since. Are those two things mutually exclusive? Can you have the correct edit and then if it is someone's view, people will have different views that Donald Trump was responsible for what happened on January 6th, then people can reach that conclusion, but it gives the correct context and the correct sequence of what he had to say.
Of course. Again, we're not disagreeing here. These two things aren't mutually exclusive. The edit shouldn't have happened, clearly. But as I say, that edit may have misrepresented what Donald Trump said in that moment. It did not fundamentally, and nor did that whole program, by the way, because of course that was just one edit in an overall, I think, 30-minute or 60-minute, I forget, program, did not fundamentally alter what Donald Trump did. And I just find it a very peculiar thing that we're basically... I've worked at the BBC when sometimes they've made a mistake when they've accused someone of doing something that they haven't done, up to and including very, very serious crimes. That's a very, very serious problem. It is true that Donald Trump did not say, as that image or that sort of 10 seconds would suggest, it was not that exact sequence of sentences. But it would be wrong to suggest likewise that somehow just because that edit took place and misrepresented him for that 10 seconds, that there was a wider misrepresentation of what he said and did that day, because that did not take place in that program. So I think, quite frankly, this is being blown out of all proportion for the substance of the issue at hand.
And that is the newsagent's co-host, Lewis Goodall, there, talking about the BBC. And I'm sure coverage of this will continue across all ABC platforms throughout the day. Will Tasmania get an AFL team? That is the question that'll essentially be decided by the state's upper house next month, after the lower house last night approved of plans to build this 23,000-seat, billion-dollar-plus stadium at Macquarie Point on Hobart's waterfront. The stadium is a condition of the AFL granting the state its long-desired football team. And while some are hoping that the league is eventually open to renegotiating the stadium, right now it's holding firm. But unlike in the lower house, this proposal is looking a lot shakier in the Legislative Council, where three independents are needed for it to pass. One, who said that she wants the stadium, but not at any cost, is independent Bec Thomas. Here's her interview with Sally Sara.
I've said from the outset that with my heart, I support a stadium. Tasmania deserves to have the infrastructure that other states have, and we deserve to have an AFL team, but not at any cost. And I think part of the issue here has been that people haven't had answers to all the questions they've been asking. And as a member of the Legislative Council, I've certainly not had the answers that I need, and I still have questions. So in terms of the government's handling of this project from the very start and their communication around it, it's not been ideal. And I think that's led to some of the division that we've seen in our community because the issue of the stadium has become terribly divisive. And that's really sad because an AFL team is something that this state has long wanted and deserves. And it's something that should be uniting our community. And instead, because of the requirement for a stadium, it's really divided us.
Why do you think this proposal for the Macquarie Point Stadium has been so divisive?
Well, I think a couple of key issues are the concerns around the site, the location itself, and the size and scale of the project. You know, it's a really significant area around Sullivan's Cove, and the historic properties of the area are something that are regarded highly by Tasmanians. And so the site and, you know, the impact that it will have on the area, as well as transport and access issues, are a key concern. But I think the number one concern is the cost and our state's ability to pay. We've just had this, you know, concerns about the government's handling of the TT line, Spirit's debacle, where we've managed to purchase at exorbitant cost two new ships and not built a berth to be able to bring them home at the same time. So, you know, there's concerns around the government's capacity and ability to deliver another significant project, both in terms of capability and the actual cost. You know, we are looking towards $13 billion of debt, and Treasury has simply said that economic growth on its own isn't going to be enough to get the government out of the terrible financial position that the state is in. And the government's not proposing any new revenue measures in order to fix the budget crisis that we're facing. So, you know, it's proposing to deliver a $1.13 billion at least stadium, dollar stadium, with no new revenue measures to be able to pay for it. So Tasmanians are really concerned that the services that they rely on every day are going to be affected by, you know, paying back the interest on the borrowings required to build this stadium.
And you were just listening to Bec Thomas, a Tasmanian independent, speaking to Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. At the start of next month, she will be voting on the proposed stadium in Tasmania's Legislative Council. We're going to end with the big news of the week, and the Liberal Party has formally dumped its commitment to net zero emissions by 2050. It is now negotiating with the Nationals to settle on a coalition energy policy. Later on, you'll hear from Radio National Breakfast's Friday political panel. But before that, the man commissioned by Susan Lee to formulate the coalition's energy policy, Dan Tehan. He is the Shadow Minister for Energy and Emissions Reduction, and he's had to manage these negotiations inside the Liberal Party. He joined Sally this morning.
You've said that this policy change is to prioritise the delivery of affordable energy to Australians. How will you deliver cheaper power?
Well, we'll get more supply into the system, and we'll get more supply into the system quicker. And we will prioritise all technologies, all types of supply of getting that into the system. And as you know, the basics of economics is that if you can get more supply, that will put downward pressure on prices. So that's what we are going to do. So we'll have a technology neutral, affordable energy scheme, and then we will create a long-term reliability mechanism. And we are very, very confident that by bringing all of Australia's natural resources to this equation, that we will be able to put downward pressure on energy.
Earlier this morning, I was speaking with the CEO of the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, and she was saying that really the drivers for some of the increases in prices have been with coal and gas, and particularly selling gas overseas, and that renewables remain the most affordable. What's your evidence that renewables are making the process more expensive for consumers?
Because people are seeing it every single day in their electricity bills. Now, as you know, Chris Bowen and Anthony Albanese promised the Australian people on over 90 occasions that electricity bills by the end of this year would be down by $275. They've gone up by 39% instead. Now, what we want to make sure is that we are bringing all resources to putting downward pressure.
We know that the remaining coal-powered power stations are ageing, and to extend their life is a significant expense. How are you going to build or extend these power stations in time before the old ones retire?
Well, this is already happening. And of course, this is one of the inconvenient truths that Chris Bowen will never talk about. But we've seen already the Victorian State Labor government seek to extend coal-fired generation in Victoria. We've seen the New South Wales Labor government do it as well. And they're in further discussions with Eraring in New South Wales to see how they can extend that. And also in Queensland, we saw their roadmap, their technology roadmap that they released recently, which is all about making sure one component of that, that their existing coal assets can last as long as they possibly can.
Who will pay for those to extend? Will you force business to pay for that, or will it be taxpayers funding those extensions federal perspective?
Obviously, what is occurring now is it's business and state governments, state Labor governments in Victoria and New South Wales. And when it comes to gas, obviously the South Australian Labor government. And what we have said is we would support existing generation with modest targeted underwriting, like what is occurring with wind and solar at the moment, but only that, because Chris Bowen doesn't even want to mention the word gas.
Will you be releasing the modelling on which the Liberal Party's policy decisions have been made?
Our first priority is to try and get the government to be transparent when it comes to their modelling. They're the government. They were the ones who made the promise that they would reduce.
You're the alternative government. Will you release yours? You can't force the government, but you can decide on yours?
Well, in good time, we will release the full suite of our policies, and we will also indicate what that will do to put downward pressure on energy prices.
But to clarify, with the modelling, with your modelling or without the modelling?
Well, we'll wait and see. I mean, what we will do from opposition is make sure that our suite of policies is offered.
Yesterday, Independent Monique Ryan said that a coalition holds 9 of 88 urban seats, and in urban seats, climate change is recognised. How are you going to win back some of those city seats without a commitment to net zero?
Well, because we're recognising that climate change is real, that we have to do our fair share, but we will do that in a balanced way. And I think people will understand that. They don't want us racing ahead of the rest of the world, costing us manufacturing jobs, costing us industry jobs, and putting unrealistic and unreasonable pressure on households because of their electricity bills. I mean, we've got to make sure that what we're doing is making energy affordability our number one priority. And that works not only in my electorate, but in all electorates right across Australia, because everyone understands how absolutely fundamental energy is to our nation and also to their household budget.
And on Radio National Breakfast, that was Dan Tehan, the Shadow Minister for Energy and Emissions Reduction. Well, we continued this conversation with our Friday political panel, featuring Jason Katsoukas, the Saturday Paper's special correspondent, along with Katina Curtis, the Canberra Bureau Chief with the West Australian, and our own Mel Clark, Radio National Breakfast's political correspondent. Katina began with her assessment of just what the Liberal Party has done here.
They've basically given the Conservative elements in the party nearly everything they wanted. I think that there's an element of leadership in here as well. Susan Lee trying to protect her own leadership, that is. The problem from her is going to be, well, you've given them this, they're not going to stop. You know, there's already mutterings that the next issue, they'll now say thanks very much and start agitating on immigration as the next issue. It certainly, as you say, walks away from bipartisan position on, you know, Australia's approach on the international stage on climate change. I did have a quick chat with some investor types yesterday who said, as far as investment uncertainty, actually it's probably a little bit of a moot point because no one really thinks the Liberals are going to win the next election anyway. So they're at best, you know, 5 years away from implementing this policy, not two.
Jason, what do you think of the electoral implications of this, particularly trying to win back city seats, which the Liberals would need to do to thread the needle to get back into office?
Well, certainly those urban MPs that lost their seats at the last election, people like Keith Wallahan, are of the view that this is not going to help the Liberals win back those seats. And that's what the polling certainly says. But it is a bit untested in terms of where public opinion will go here, because we've had a bipartisan consensus on net zero up until this point. So it might be like The Voice, that once the bipartisan consensus breaks down, support for net zero will go collapse as well.
What about the relationship between the Liberal Party and the National Party? Is the tail wagging the dog here? Someone who did look pretty happy yesterday afternoon was Barnaby Joyce.
Barnaby Joyce is happy. David Littleproud is happy. Whatever divisions there were in the Nationals before, I think they're in a pretty comfortable position now where they feel like they have command over policy direction. This will embolden the Nationals to continue to push their majority partner to different policy positions, because each time they've tried, they've succeeded. So that dynamic will continue, and that will play against the kinds of Liberal candidates that we're just talking about. Keith Wallahan, who lost his seat, Tim Wilson, who's trying to talk about how difficult it is to win back a seat from a teal independent. Those seats talked very much about the damage that the Liberal Party, seeing to be led by the Nationals, caused them at the last election. Well, that will only be exacerbated this time around if this same dynamic continues.
And that was Mel Clark there, ending the political panel and the breakfast wrap for this week, along with Jason Katsoukas and Katina Curtis. They're in the studio with Sally Sara, who presents everything that you've heard right across the week. The interviews were produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and the breakfast wrap was produced today by Josie Scott. Our executive producer is, as always, Eleni Saltis, and I'm Luke Sydenham-Dundon. And just a reminder of what we were doing earlier in the week, out in the cold outside the front of Old Parliament House in Canberra, marking the 50th anniversary of the dismissal.
I went to Earls Court to sort of find some other Australians, and they were all saying, go to the embassy. So we went to the Australian embassy, and there was a huge crowd, and everyone was crying out for Gough, we want Gough. Gough, we want Gough and sack Kerr.
So we all got up from our desks and walked over to Parliament House. We were angry, and there were lots of public servants because it was, you know, in the parliamentary triangle.
You can catch our special episode of The Breakfast Wrap. It's up on the ABC Listen app. Just search for Radio National Breakfast, scroll down and you'll find it in the stream. But thanks again for listening this week. We'll see you next Monday. Same time, same place.